have the experience of seeing our own potential and our own divinity when we connect to our greater selves. Part of the paralysis lies in the simplicity of the solution, as both Krishna and Patanjali lay out in their own way. To follow your Dharma, turn in, connect with yourself, relinquish the I for the selfless service to the greater humanity, meditate and renounce attachment to results and objects through simply providing service. It is a straight-up prescription for the path of yoga, and both proponents guarantee the results are a life of meaning and joy. But as we know from understanding what is involved in the previous steps, it is difficult to relinquish the habits and patterns we have picked up over our lives and in the collective culture we are born into. It's hard to stop being human after all. You can liken this process of letting go and the difficulty of releasing your grip to the imaginal cells of a caterpillar undergoing its metamorphosis to a butterfly. The caterpillar has within it the cells of change for its cyclical evolution. When the process begins, the caterpillar body fights the cells that appear to bring about the change, seeing them as an enemy of its immune system. As the internal battle rages between caterpillar cells and butterfly cells, eventually the balance shifts, and the number of butterfly cells outweighs those caterpillar cells that are holding on to the old form and old ways of being. Once this balance is tipped, the new cells can do their work, bringing forth the butterfly. We are all caterpillars, feeling the emergence of the innate understanding in us that change is necessary for us to evolve. But our imaginal cells fight it and cling to the things that have previously served us, the behaviors and feelings that we know, even if only on a conscious level, aren't serving us. The metaphor of Arjuna's battle is apt, as making change in our life, finding our good hustle, often feels like a battle. It's confusing and exhausting, and all we want is for it to be over and peace to reign. This is where the story of the Gita is so familiar and relatable. Arjuna is at the point of collapse in a painful identity crisis. He knows the war of Kurukshetra is necessary, and to a degree inevitable, and that there is no quick and easy way to get it over with, as all civil negotiations have failed. The battle is going to change the face of civilization. Arjuna is unable to see beyond the now to the greater benefits he will experience once the fighting is over. He is desperately looking for ways to maintain the status quo, to keep everyone happy, while knowing that this solution will result in no one being happy. When we make change in ourselves, especially when these changes begin to reveal the truth of our own inner butterflies, there is a ripple effect without and within. Resistance will come from your peers, your colleagues, your family, and loved ones. We are all sleeping caterpillar cells, and the awakening butterfly of one of us challenges the rest to look at their own lives and take inventory of their sense of fulfillment and purpose. You will undoubtedly be challenged, both gently and critically, when you start to reveal that you aspire to renounce your attachments and seek a life of Dharma. These reactions will happen, I guarantee it, when you first broach the idea of, say, leaving your job to pursue your good hustle ideas. The prevailing idea in society seems to be that it is better to be unhappy and unfulfilled than seek to step outside of the suffering and try. Treasure the humans who instantly get where you're coming from and encourage you. Keep them in your inner circle and invite them to be part of your process of growth. It's best to avoid evangelizing and trying to convince others to follow once you have leapt into your good hustle zone, as each of us has to work through the 8 steps at our own pace. We have to have collapsed in our chariots and thrown our hands in the air, wondering if this is all there is, surrendering to our version of Krishna for answers to our despair. And of course the answers come, and they come from within. And they come through preparing ourselves to hear the gentle whisper of our heart through reaching the stage of dhyana. The strength and stamina it takes to reach this state of stillness are quite impressive. Think of a dam wall holding up a crashing, thundering expanse of water. And it certainly feels to the meditator that there are too many holes and not enough fingers. But remember, this patience and observance are in themselves part of the process. There is growth and benefit at every stage of our progress, and in the spirit of the seeker, reaching the end is not the goal, It is the experience of living the practice that helps us reach the end and our goal, samadhi. Number 8, samadhi. Patanjali describes this eighth and final stage of Ashtanga, samadhi, as a state of ecstasy. At this stage, the yogi merges with their point of focus and transcends the self altogether. A profound connection to the divine is realized, and there is an interconnectedness with all living things. Read this not as a lofty and unachievable religious or spiritual goal. If we return to our earlier discussion of how we individually define the divine, this merging is with that divinity that delivers us peace, contentment, and happiness. Not just for ourselves, but through knowing that this is a state bestowed on all things. The state of enlightenment isn't like falling through a rabbit hole into the inky nothingness of thoughtless ecstasy. Samadhi is a state of action and equanimity. This is the goal for your good hustle. It is a thoroughly ambitious undertaking, delivering you to a place far greater than the individual I, as you provide service to the world and gain samadhi as a result. As Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita, there is a certain kind of action that leads to freedom and fulfillment. Krishna and the Gita are full of kernels of wisdom for the Dharma seeker that reinforce the peril of stasis, reiterating the call to arms for those of us who have begun to wake up, feel the creeping sense of dissatisfaction with the things, and they are things, that we used to think brought happiness. Denying your yearning for something more meaningful is in itself an action, and as we have discussed, karma is accrued with all actions. If action is unavoidable, we may as well make sure that it is action that points us in the direction of our own divinity. The trick of the light is that divinity is, should, and can be a very everyday event. It is in fact the everydayness of it that makes samadhi a worthwhile and achievable goal, and inextricably links it to good hustle. In trying to snap Arjuna out of his malaise, Krishna is continually reiterating that the pursuit of Dharma is the way to divinity, and a portal to samadhi when done right. What is clear from Krishna's message in the Gita is that finding your Dharma happens through taking action, and is one of the action steps not attached to the fruits of labor. This is what separates your good hustle, that the actions you are taking are not motivated by your own self-aggrandizement. Dedicating your business practice to something bigger than you decouples the way you approach work. No longer does it only exist for you and your limited worldview. It exists as an integral part of the world. Gandhi is perhaps one of the greatest exponents of the shift in perspective when living a life dedicated to a good hustle and of what can be achieved. His dedication to not being human has made him an enduring icon of morality and ethics to all humanity. Gandhi's life was transformed when he first read the Gita. In his autobiography, he details how up to that point his life had been somewhat of a litany of failure and shame, at least from the perspective of his family. Gandhi's identification with the fears and neuroses of Arjuna enabled him to take the advice of Krishna. Gandhi wholeheartedly surrendered himself to the process of finding out what his purpose was. He changed his diet, his friends, and radically simplified his way of living. He took to daily meditation and mantra practice. Gandhi, in his profession as a lawyer, had been just scraping by on his shallow legal knowledge. His final transformation came when he was working on a difficult and divisive case in South Africa between two families, spookily not unlike the Pandavas and the Kauravas of the Gita. Although this had the potential to be very lucrative for Gandhi as a young lawyer, with years in litigation of the complex conflict spanning ahead of him, he could see the pain it was causing both sides and the damage that was being done. He made it his mission to convince the litigants to go to arbitration and drop the court case. When he successfully managed to negotiate a mutually acceptable compromise between them, it was the moment his own good hustle became clear, working to unite parties in conflict. Knowledge became wisdom. Gandhi realized that when he was in union with his Dharma, there was nothing he couldn't attempt. Gandhi wasn't a man blinded by faith or beguiled by religion without wisdom. In his desperate search for meaning in his life while living in England and studying, he had vigorously researched the seminal text of all the world's major religions to try and discover something that gave him insight into finding peace and happiness. He concluded that all of the texts more or less prescribe the same thing, and that no matter what culture and faith we are born into, we are all at heart looking within for the path to our true selves. For Gandhi, the Gita was the book that gave a clear and simple step-by-step approach to how to do so, a method that any seeker could adopt and use within their own belief system. Gandhi's commentary on the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita according to Gandhi, is a beautiful and straightforward analysis of the text. In the book, he relates Krishna's advice to Arjuna to everyday situations with the belief that the teaching should be accessible, understandable, and actionable for everyone, from heads of state to street vendors, ensuring that enlightenment wasn't just a conceit for the elite. The combination of action with the idea of a lack of attachment, as we have trained ourselves for in the previous eight limbs of the sutras, is essential in your preparation for the creation of your good hustle. The single act of mastering non-attachment is in itself a form of samadhi. What better way to experience the absence of suffering than not being a slave to endless litanies of objects and emotions built on a foundation of your own destructive fictions? This is freedom. As Gandhi discovered, with surrender to the known unknown and selfless service as the motivator of all action, there is little that can't be achieved. As Krishna says in the Gita, performing action without attachment, man shall attain the supreme. When the eye of the ego isn't attached to action, the limitations are removed. You don't attach your inner patterns of not being enough to what you're doing, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure and shame. You merely get on and begin, knowing that you're being guided by your inner wisdom, which is now a clear, strong voice after the training of the sutras. The legacy that Gandhi left to the world as an exemplar of living a life in an entirely authentic and imperfect way has been expansive. The change he achieved was nothing short of miraculous. We can learn subtler lessons from Gandhi by studying the source of his courage and prescience that enabled him to undertake the breathtakingly subversive acts of non-violence that freed his people from British rule. As part of his adherence to the teachings of the Gita, Gandhi relied entirely on his inner voice and moral compass. He used extended periods of concentration and meditation to guide his actions, and had no qualms in changing his direction in a dramatic and unexpected way if he felt he was being guided to do so. Such was his faith in surrender and following his Dharma. By choosing his own access to understanding what the right path was, Gandhi wasn't swayed by opinion or tethered to what others thought. Gandhi modelled agility and a reliance on his intuition skills indubitably honed by his strict yoga and meditation practice. While in London he had practiced the austerity of simplifying his life, ridding himself of unnecessary possessions at the same time as he was working through cleaning his mind. In Gandhi's autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth, he talks about the expansive freedom he felt the less he had. It's a concept that is almost unimaginable to so many of us as we strive almost exclusively to acquire or to pay for the things we have already acquired. His renunciation, however, was not about leaving the world and hanging in a cave or monastery. This is the legacy most useful to us as aspiring good hustle people, that we can have it all. We can do it all by having none of it. In the books and workshops run by motivational business coaches and successful entrepreneurs, so many familiar motivational catchphrases are trotted out. We need to have big, hairy, audacious goals, one of my most despised phrases. We need to be the change, co-opted from one of Gandhi's own mantras. We need to fake it till we make it, see previous rant. There is a sense of striving and perpetual movement to reach the pinnacle of achievement that doesn't speak to the most important processes of silence, sitting, self-study, surrender, and finally becoming one with ourselves or with God, or however you conceive this practice of samadhi. One long-time yogi I spoke to was strongly of the opinion that we shouldn't even consider samadhi in our practice of becoming good hustlers. She felt it was not ever reachable. I counter this belief, which came from her context of spiritual practice, with the view that we can find our heavens on earth. What Patanjali in the sutras and Krishna in the Gita have described as the contemplation of the yogic path is, I believe, what deep down all of us aspire to, peace and contentment, a sense of purpose and meaning in our lives. This ultimate stage of yoga, enlightenment, can't be bought or possessed. It can only be experienced, and as such, it is the process of the practice and is far more accessible than is realized. As you set out on your mission to find your good hustle, your strategy begins within. The first step is knowing who you are. You need to have a guiding motivation that you have surrendered to in love and the courage of knowing that you can't fail when you are living in your Dharma. The idea of failure is defunct when you aren't being measured against limited beliefs. You need to be confident that your nirvana or samadhi or union with the divine doesn't happen at the end of the rainbow. It is the rainbow and the reason for stepping out of what we experience as being human and into the place of being for humanity instead. When you truly begin to break your attachment to objects and permanence and realize the impermanent nature of everything, your loose grip on life will make everything simpler and you more content. If you can't control it, you don't have to worry about how you're going to. So you flow along and take opportunities as they present themselves, rather than as you create them. When you do create them, you do so with courage and without limitation, looking always to the single guiding principle that your motivation is to serve others with love and contribute to the peace and happiness of all sentient beings. This is the blueprint for good hustling. As Krishna broke it down in the Gita for Arjuna, find your Dharma, look to it as you look within, stay committed and disciplined to get your mind in order until you have the clarity to see without doubt what is your calling. When you have seen that vision of your own capacity, unlimited by your mortal flaws, do not let anything obscure your pursuit of delivering that goal to the world. Relinquish the fruits of your actions. What Krishna intended by this was to give the outcomes and expectations away and simply be nourished by the intention and the daily joys found in the present moment. Dedicate all of your actions to honoring your divinity, however you understand and experience that. This isn't an end game, as the possibilities are such that you will experience moments of the essence of samadhi, moments of peace and contentment that will push you along and compel you to keep going until there is only keeping going. And what compels you is the sheer imperfect perfection of living in your Dharma. Pain and suffering. Throughout the Good Hustle, I've talked about attachment and material spirituality as things to be overcome, renounced, and relinquished. It is why I'm writing and you are reading this book, looking for a way to get back to you. Although it is woven throughout, I wanted to give this topic a dedicated space in the text, as it sits at the heart of suffering and the human condition. I'm going out on a limb that if you are reading this, you are not living in a cave or a forest at one with divinity, nibbling on roots and berries between meditation sessions. You are undoubtedly in the thick of the world, ticking each Kali Yuga day off the calendar. Until we really, deeply, truly get the problem with attachment and make some inroads in our self-cherishing to kill it off at the root, attainment of good hustles, happy lives, and peaceful hearts is elusive. What's Kali Yuga, I hear you say? I'm so glad you asked. You remember our friends, Krishna and Arjuna, at the edge of the battlefield, dealing with Arjuna's existential crisis? As we know, after a long and insightful talk by Krishna, Arjuna reconnects with his Dharma and saves the day, upholding what is right by fighting for what is wrong. In his case, the Pandavas' approach to grabbing land and people. Spoiler alert, Arjuna survives and morality along with him. Kali Yuga is, according to the Sanskrit scriptures, the age of the demon Kali. In the Mahabharata, the book from which the Bhagavad Gita is an excerpt, it is said that this age begins with the ending of the Battle of Kurukshetra. The attributes of Kali Yuga were detailed as a spiritual dark age, where the emphasis on values shifted from faith, moral justice, and the practice of the Hindu scriptures, to a time dominated by greed, violence, and a general disregard for the types of conduct extolled in the Yoga Sutras. There is, in fact, a spooky level of detail around the predictions of what would happen during the age of the Kali Yuga in another Sanskrit classic, the Srimad Bhagavatam. Cities will be dominated by thieves. the Vedas will be contaminated by speculative interpretations of atheists, in other words, fake news. Political leaders will virtually consume the citizens, and the so-called priests and intellectuals will be devotees of their bellies and genitals. That feels awkwardly true right now. Other predictions include the breakdown of intergenerational caring and support for parents, the rise of religious dogma to political power from non-spiritual men, and an increase in the devastating impacts of snow, rain, fire and drought, putting pressures on populations for food and water security. Also predicted is the rise of wealth as a symbol of power, sex and physical attraction dominating love as a base for relationships, and people developing a hatred for each other, leading to the capacity to kill over minor differences. Yep, I think we've ticked all those boxes. Kali Yuga principally speaks to a loss of faith and of individuals caring for anything and anyone, including nature, and the outcomes this has for society and people. The age is predicted to last a long time. The end date is still hotly debated by Vedic mathematicians and astrologers, but it is estimated to be in around 423,000 years. And it doesn't end well. Human life gets shorter and shorter, and the inhabitants of once mighty civilizations are reduced to grubbing around for roots and berries to survive. But putting apocalyptic predictions to one side, Kali Yuga, as described by Krishna in the Gita, is a pretty accurate description of the state we find ourselves in now. The shift away from living with a collective desire for happiness, wellness, and a lack of suffering. The absence of divinity that accepts and includes everyone, even and especially those who don't share your beliefs. And a solo and singular approach to living, resulting in a sense of isolation and separateness, is a summation of the experience of life in the 21st century. Whether or not you believe a document written 5,000 years ago by a Hindu sage has relevance to where we find ourselves now, we can't argue with the generalized view that as countries accrue more wealth and attain standards of living ever higher than previous generations, we appear sicker and unhappier than ever. So whether it is a function of Kali Yuga, or an excess of consumption combined with a high value placed on material wealth, it seems that the causal strand is a passionate attachment to things, leading to what Buddhists call suffering. I call it stuffering, as it is the acquisition and clinging to stuff in the belief that it is the root of happiness that is at the heart of most of our misery. The eight worldly dharmas. In Buddhism, this stuff is known as the eight worldly dharmas, or eight worldly concerns. These are kind of the opposite of the dharma we want to be cultivating. The eight worldly dharmas bind us to relationships with material objects. Where the Buddha Dharma is the path to enlightenment, the eight worldly dharmas keep us trapped in samsara or suffering. These eight worldly dharmas, like everything, exist in the mind. The approach of Buddhism to the real and unreal, to reiterate, is that fundamentally we create things in our mind, and it is through our minds that we create the relationships and narratives about them. A book, for example, is made up of atoms. But when we look at a book, or hold a book, we think it is a solid piece of stuff. What we see and feel is a direct result of our experience of books. We classify and categorize the object and assign value. It's good or bad, and makes us nostalgic, reverent or excited, and see it and our relationship to it as permanent. Make sure you have your head around this, as it is at the root of how attachment is understood, and how this leads to all things and our attachment to them being an illusion. If books aren't your thing, said no one ever, then do the same exercise with a pet, a living object made of protons, neutrons and electrons. You're unlikely to look at a dog and simply think that this is an animal that is called a dog made of atoms. You would look at it and feel a rush of love, a desire to pat it, an attachment of value about its fur colour, texture and breed. Or alternately, if you had experienced negative interactions with dogs, you might experience fear or revulsion or anger, or even hunger, depending on your cultural relationship to sources of protein. None of these feelings change the reality of the makeup of that living object, but for you, that dog exists in your mind in a unique way that will not be experienced by anyone else. In both of these examples, you experience attachment or aversion, cling to it, or desire to be free of the experience as soon as possible. In all things we know, we have created them in our minds and understand them according to our personal experience. Attachment to what we have created and how we respond to it in the Buddhist traditions is samsara. It's suffering. And the only way to avoid the pain of suffering is to renounce the world. Don't worry if your mind just exploded. Understanding impermanence can take lifetimes and is a pretty serious philosophical road to go down. But like so many other big philosophical ideas we have bravely squared off against in the Good Hustle, the key is you know it is there, that these questions without answers exist, and that you can use them as a tool if and when it suits to help shape your own philosophies and beliefs. The eight worldly dharmas are laid out in pairs and are as follows. The craving or attachment to something, and the craving to be free from craving for it. The craving for physical comfort and the aversion to discomfort. The craving for positive praise and the aversion to criticism. And the craving for a good reputation and the aversion to having your reputation trashed. Attachment to things, craving to be free from craving. The first two are pretty common, and what we would generally recognize as attachment, craving for stuff and craving to be free from attachment to stuff. Along with possessions, I'd also add in food and other sensory consumables here. The craving for stuff is a serious problem for folks from the West to the East, from developing to very developed nations. This is the stuff of suffering, and we can't get enough of it. Literally. We know all the stages of stuff. Wanting it. Getting it. Keeping it. Disposing of it. Sharing it. Not sharing it. Comparing it. Being disappointed with it. And we know stuff doesn't make us happy. Even if we're adopting a sincere attitude of having a light footprint and divesting ourselves of stuff, there is the reverse suffering of being attached to not getting attached and doing without. This includes the pride and judgment that attaches to being righteous about how good we are at saying no to stuff, which is simply another form of having an attachment. It's a tricky space to navigate, and it does sometimes feel impossible to get the balance right. The point about attachment and the eight worldly dharmas, as I understand it, is not that we can't have the objects. It is the subtlety of both not attaching to having them or to not having them. As soon as we love them or want them or need them or have pride about having them or not having them, then we are captive to them and are attached. If we instead celebrate the comfort or pleasure they bring in the moment, but can sincerely release that desire instantly, not to go to a new attachment, then we are simply flowing with what is in the moment. Lama Zopa Rinpoche reiterates this view. He says that wealth is not the problem. The problem is having a desire for wealth. Friends are not the problem. Attachment to our friends is. Objects become a problem for us because of the emotional mind of desire. Craving comfort, aversion to discomfort. The next pairing of the eight worldly dharmas comes with the same inherent dilemmas. Craving happiness and comfort, which is a strong signifier of success in our lives, is equaled in force with craving to be free from unhappiness and discomfort. There is also within these cravings another bridge of attachment, which is a fear of losing the comfort and happiness you have already attained. You're trapped, coming or going. Happiness and its pursuit is the locus for so much suffering. And the problem lies not in any of the things of the external world. It lies within our mind. When we equate happiness with any of the eight worldly dharmas, which are what constitutes our Western understandings of happiness, not one of them is linked to our internal state of being or our capacity for connection to others and our own divinity. The achievement of this state, gained by releasing our minds from illusions through yoga, meditation, living in Dharma, and offering ourselves in love, is where happiness lies. This is not what we are told about happiness and comfort from our earliest arrival into the world. We're referencing Abraham H. Maslow's hierarchy of needs to understand what the basic elements of survival and thrival are for humans. Maslow, a psychologist, released his heavily adopted theory of human self-actualization in 1943 with his paper, A Theory of Human Motivation. In it, he created a pyramid that is a neat summation of the eight worldly dharmas. All of his prescriptions for happiness are provided by external sources. In this context, it is completely understandable how and why everything we do and see is predicated on happiness and comfort being given to us, and therefore at constant risk of being taken away. It is all in our mindset and approach to the encounters we have with what we believe is happiness and comfort, and our reaction to it. Consider temperature. On a hot summer's day, we encounter a room that is cool. We were sweating in the heat, drowning in humidity, hot and bothered with the world, and desperate to get some respite. The heat of the day and getting away from it were completely dominating our thoughts. We were caught in suffering. When we encounter an air-conditioned space, our day and feeling of happiness are transformed. It is blissful, cool. We calm down. Our mood becomes light and joyful. Cool makes us happy. Heat makes us suffer. We want to avoid heat and encounter cool. Then the opposite occurs. In winter, cool does not make us happy. Cool and the happiness it brings are contextual and impermanent. But we cling to it and the feeling and imagine that we are happy because of the value we attach to the feeling of temperature control. The Buddhist teachings on attachment say that this is our reaction to everything. We hop from a brief moment of what we think is happiness to the next, with a chasm of despair and craving between each pleasurable encounter. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, in How to Practice Dharma, says, "For most of us, success in life means success in obtaining the four desirable objects. But actually, this is only success in achieving suffering, because desire by its very nature disturbs our mental continuum and causes dissatisfaction." Heat and cold are states we physically pass through. Yes, they are visceral. But like the thoughts that plague us during meditation, we can simply choose to observe our reactions to sensation impassively and not become a player in our own mini-drama as we react and try to reach the sensation that we equate with happiness. I know this is hard to hear and hard to apply. Happiness is etched in stone in our minds as a result of collecting over our lives the ingredients we are taught create the recipe for a perfect life. Love, which comes from another. Shelter, which is external to us. Wealth, which is never enough. Respect and admiration from our community, which is terrifyingly transient. Consider the time it takes to actually achieve and maintain these states across a lifetime. No wonder it is such a struggle for us to find time to meditate and look for our own inner happiness. Craving praise, aversion to criticism. Most of us don't love being criticized, primarily because we take criticism so personally and have fixed mindsets where we don't see criticism as a pathway to growth and change. Praise, however, is like a nice big sugar hit where our egos get momentary satiation before crashing back to earth. As a highly unevolved human with a taste for praise, I realized how much of my suffering was linked to craving recognition and praise for what I did. The flip side of this was the fear of what would happen if I lost my status as a good girl and was criticized. I've discussed in the opening chapters my personal experience of how exhausting and futile the hunt for praise is. Growth mindset is a salve to this external striving and hiding from mistakes being found out. By knowing that mistakes lead to growth and attainment of competence, receiving criticism is the step before getting better. Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, says that the ability to listen to feedback is a sign of resilience. I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and I know you can reach them, is how she ends her performance reviews. She isn't crushing her people. She is offering them the truth, and with it the opportunity for change and strength. When receiving criticism becomes your superpower, then you will eagerly seek it. If it's delivered clumsily or feels a little personal, you'll be able to see the kindness that lies beneath, or at worst, understand the value of the message and lay the rest aside. Craving a good reputation, aversion to having your reputation trashed. Craving a good reputation and its inverse, craving to be free from having your reputation destroyed, are the final two worldly dharmas to renounce. When I first read the teaching on the eight worldly dharmas and understood the full extent of my attachment to things, I was deeply shocked. It seemed that everything I wanted and aspired to was one of the eight worldly dharmas. Biggest and most disturbing on the eight worldly dharma hit list for me were the pairings around praise and reputation. I had never considered these as an attachment I suffered from. Nailing these ones is perhaps trickier than nailing those based on finding happiness in tangible objects. When our happiness and identity are so strongly built on inputs that are external to us, our foundations are understandably shaky at best. The facade constructed over a lifetime of who we are, linked to what others think and how they reflect their favourable perceptions to us, can be decimated in a matter of minutes. We've all seen the big names and reputations fall from grace, and the difficulty those people ever have in regaining their status. If so much time is spent second-guessing others' reactions to us, then doing nothing is a pretty good way of ensuring that our reputations stay intact. I think reputational considerations are particularly relevant when you're ascertaining what to do with your life and work. Hopefully by now, you will have turned your focus to pursuing a path of alignment with your dharma. A lot of the conflict that arises within ourselves at this time, when our true nature of self emerges, is in wondering what people are going to think of us when we start our unfolding. Remember the quote at the outset about the greatest regrets of the dying being that they hadn't spent more time doing what they felt was a true expression of who they were? I hazard a guess that if you had asked why these people hadn't acted, the answer would have been at its root a fear of reputational damage and judgment from loved ones or strangers about their choices. When we hand over control to external forces, real or imagined, this is what we get. Indian yogin poet Sri Aurobindo said, "The spiritual journey is one of continually falling on your face, getting up, brushing yourself off, and taking another step." You must find courage and humour to undertake the good hustle. In the sage words of author and spiritual teacher Ram Dass, "I have made a public ass of myself, and what I do is the minute I fall on my face, I publicly claim it because I realise that it helps other people and it encourages them to have a willingness to risk in their spiritual work." Just sit with that and imagine the freedom of being an ass and owning it, rather than taking the perpetual airbrush to your life. Many things about undertaking a spiritual path take what is often described as courage. It sits unchallenged in our language that we need to have extreme levels of bravery to follow our dharma or our paths to our true selves. It would be more helpful if we equally commonly use the expression that it takes fear and cowardice to be tethered to the views and thoughts of other people, who themselves are drowning in fear and attachment. How to stop being human. This idea loops us back to where we started with the childhood question of what we want to be when we grow up. It is a question usually posed by adults with authority and status much greater than ours. The answer to the question always has an explicit or implicit value assignment, which teaches us from a very early age about judgment, approval and disapproval being handed out to us by those who have power over us. And not just our future work choices. It is all forms of our personal expression, our bodies, our sexuality, our choice of friends, of pastimes, faith, or just about whatever. Shame is instilled and internalized early on and becomes another form of mental suffering that is used to shut down our yearnings for the life we are drawn to live. Think back across your life to the moments you remember letting go of a dream or aspiration because it didn't fit in with the scheme of things laid out for you. It is well worth revisiting early moments in your life where you had clear moments of happiness and contentment, where you believed you were without limitations. I'm not talking about desire here. I'm talking about the clarity we have as children to somehow see our paths and our truths more clearly, without modifying or second-guessing why we can't do things. I'm not suggesting our parents and teachers redirect us because they want us to live a life of suffering away from our true selves. They do it because it was done to them, and because, through early interventions, they want to stop us from suffering, and because they are terribly afraid of reputational damage for us and for them by proxy. This is the cycle of the eight worldly dharmas that has to be broken in order to achieve happiness, and the achievement of this happiness comes from renouncing life. Renunciation. How do we renounce life while being in the world? If we are following the Buddhist logic that we have born into these very specific bodies and lives in Western families and countries, or wherever you are engaging with this text, then we are already in the right place at the right time. So what is so wrong? There is nothing wrong per se, as a lack of awareness and continuation of that cycle is the reality for most folk. But as you've begun the quest for your dharma, for your happiness, and have opened the door to the question of attachment and suffering through your quest for self-awareness and a path to enlightenment, you may as well get some options on the table as to how to throw off the yoke. In the teachings of the Buddha, renunciation is renouncing the idea of permanence. If everything is impermanent, including us, our lives and our bodies, then there is nothing to be attached to. Everything changes constantly. When we have no attachment to a state being constant, then the expectation is that no matter what happens, it will be different shortly. Pain or pleasure will both come and go. People and their bodies will come and go. Thoughts will come and go. And most certainly you will come and go. So the first tiny steps to renunciation are accepting impermanence and being present to the threat of the eight worldly dharmas derailing our self-discovery through clinging and attachment to stuff. They aren't going away. It is your relationship with them that is changing and detaching. Even if you were in a cave or a monastery, suffering and attachment is in the mind, and you can take the worldly dharmas with you. Being in the world is the best place to work on renunciation, as there are so many constant reminders of how we are attached and selfish. We are heat-seeking missiles for acknowledgement and praise, and it is here we can make inroads into consciously detaching. Digital Dharma. One of the most treacherous realms to get caught in the eight worldly dharmas is also one that can be of immense benefit to your good hustle, social media, and the digital landscape more broadly. You've no doubt been working diligently on your digital strategy and how you are going to spread your message virally among all those raging evangelists for your product or service. It's likely to be where you will find your customers and your channels for having meaningful communications, especially in the development of your business pre-launch. Like so many things, the internet and social media isn't good or bad. It simply is. The value we ascribe to it, however, can turn it from a benign tool for marketing, sales, and promotion into a weapon, an addiction, and a disaster for your brand and yourself. Where previously our engagement in the sales process was one way, social media gave individuals and groups the chance to speak up and engage in the sales funnel as a two-way experience. The lean startup principles that are so critical to getting your good hustle started simply couldn't exist without a digital market to release a minimum viable product into and harvest real-time information and feedback from customers as part of the development cycle. Let me be clear, I'm not a digital denier in any way. I do, however, want to highlight some of the significant Dharma downsides of digital as you dive into your good hustle, so you are aware of the hidden traps of being always on and always on show. There's no delicate way to put this. Social media, especially Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram, are the 8 worldly Dharma atomic power tools. Want to feel bad about what you don't have? Want to develop social anxiety? Want to feel inadequate in every area of your life? Want to feel you are missing out and overwhelmed simultaneously? Want to curate your every move in fear of getting a negative comment and reap praise? Want to crush people's dreams with the absence of a like? Welcome to the worldly dharmas of Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, and Twitter. Instruments that could have been developed solely to superglue people to their egos, fuel attachments, and invite commentary from the global self-cherishing peanut gallery. Social media and its resonance with people across the world is a strong demonstration of the chasm of aloneness that connecting with acquaintances and strangers via a screen can momentarily salve. Channels like Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram allow people to be seen, to feel as though they have an audience and an ear for their lives, some recognition, and a constant source of potential approval and criticism. The very nature of social media is to elicit approval or, by the absence of likes or comments, disapproval. In many cases, the two-way feedback mechanism also invites unwelcome and unwarranted criticism, leading to bullying and passive-aggressive behaviour. This dramatically modifies the user's capacity to be themselves, speak their truth and live in their dharma, and can cause extreme suffering. What then is the best way to negotiate the necessary tools that the internet and social media provide to an emerging entrepreneur? It is very common for the clients I work with to have a deep fear of stepping out on social media, especially with a new product or idea. They are gun-shy from having seen the types of word storms unleashed on celebrities and high-profile business people, usually women, and are frightened that this will be their experience. Happily, this is relatively uncommon. A more likely pitfall of social media is that it keeps you so easily yoked to the attachments and false perceptions of the 8 worldly dharmas. We see social media like a window to the world, where everyone is looking at us critically. It is a domestic peep show, and we get up every day and perform with all the inherent performance anxiety that brings. Checking our accounts, looking at everyone else being happy and shiny, tallying up the numbers of likes and comments, noticing with hurt who hasn't liked and commented, or gushing with joy when someone we admire notices us. These are all classic descriptions of the 8 worldly dharmas in action. They are also not real. Just as Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, and even LinkedIn and the countless new and niche networks that will continue to arise are built on a fictional snapshot of our lives at a moment in time. If you are making life transformations, seeking out your Dharma path, and using digital updates to share your journey with the world, it may feel that you are being especially closely scrutinized by others for a spiritual slip-up. There is also the competition to be the best at playing the role of the spiritual soldier via your social media window. The most uplifting memes, the greenest smoothie, the best shots of you during Vrikshasana against an exotic backdrop or retreating with the Guru du Jour. Boy George put it perfectly in his post-recovery comeback album in the lyric, "My God is bigger than your God." He beautifully captured the striving that goes on in the name of being holier than thou. The performance of spirituality is quite exhausting and requires a lot of props, which of course cost money and scream attachment. The spiritual bullying that goes on by individuals and businesses that want to help you hit the big time in your new good hustle are unconscionable, using language and campaigns that would put the characters of Mad Men to shame. So be alert to this, and by all means use social media as a way to open other people's eyes to the Dharma, and to hold yourself accountable to your own commitments. But be aware of the fine line into the ego of wanting to be approved and loved by external parties as you do so. The constant parade of people's lives, loves, acquisitions, and feelings on social media can mean you are committing over and over to building the narrative of who you are for the eyes of others, rather than just being without the need for approval. Then there is the time consideration of the digital Dharma drama. In the blink of an eye that is our lifetimes, we are increasingly living in a sedentary way, looking at ourselves living our lives through social media posts. Trying to keep up with complimenting, Commenting and acknowledging everyone else's daily business is time-consuming and exhausting, especially for the hundreds and thousands of friends and followers you might be trying to manage, rather than the intimate and personal social circle that was once all that was required. And that was hard enough. The irony here is that while we are so busy worrying about our flawless photos and how everyone is looking at us, of course they actually aren't. We and they are looking at ourselves. We are looking at our own lack and craving for the things we think we need or are missing through the comparison with others' posts, building craving, aversion, attachment, and suffering in the process. What we think of ourselves is vitally important to the success of any endeavor. However, many times those judgments are not based on who we think we are, but instead fall into the category of who others think we are. We all know that someone else's opinion has minimal actual impact on our daily lives, yet we rely on these imaginary external views to fortify our public profile and actions. Actor Shirley MacLaine has summed up this preoccupation with external views in a theory she refers to as the 20-40-60 rule. According to Shirley, at 20, your life revolves around an obsession with what others think of you. At 40, you begin to not care what others think of you. And at 60, you realize that you really weren't being judged by anyone but yourself. More explicitly, that no one was thinking about anything but themselves the whole time. Shirley says that no matter what our age, we all need to be 60. And as far as social media goes, she's bang on the money. How many overweight and stiff people do you think will never do yoga because of the endless images put out by the industry of young, slim, bendy yogis in hot pants with a tropical backdrop? Yoga is the perfect remedy for so many physical and emotional illnesses, yet the barriers to starting to take a class are the perceptions about who does, should do, and can do yoga. The way the yoga industry in the West portrays an ancient science for attaining enlightenment and finding union with the divine through living right is an excellent example of the eight worldly dharmas in digital action. We are conditioned to crave being permanently young, flexible and beautiful, and we have an aversion to being stiff and old. We crave a healthy, flexible body, and we have an aversion to the pain of getting flexible through practice or not being good enough. The end result is we don't go to class or start a practice and continue to judge ourselves as not worthy of trying. And because we deny ourselves a tool that can change our lives, we suffer. If any of those feelings are the way you feel about starting your good hustle, creating a life that is full of happiness and fulfillment through being of service, then see it as your dharma to ignore them and get on with the show. Technology, as I said at the outset, is a neutral tool. There to be used to enhance our capabilities. It is up to us as humans not to be the tail wagged by the mobile device and to clearly establish in our minds, where else would we do it, our relationship to it. As with everything being endorsed in this book, if the mind is managed, the rest falls into place. Digital tools have to be part of your go-to-market strategy. Depending on what your business idea is, a social media and digital presence may be your entire business strategy. Again, we are creating a space as good hustlers living in the world, and the world, including the digital world, is where we are trying to affect our change. We need to be part of the ways of the world and the people we want to connect with. How do you actually feel when you spend minutes and cumulatively hours scrolling through other people's cataloging of the eight worldly dharmas? As an exercise in awakening, hang out on your social media channels and start to classify each post. Is it displaying material things or comfort, such as new purchases, gifts, friends, food, booze, holidays, pets and kids? Or good reputation and praise, such as new jobs, awards, achievements and recognition by authorities in the sector? Take the time to recognize how much of the display of social media is the embodiment of the eight worldly dharmas and how this makes you feel. When you're auditing the posts, think to yourself, do I need to respond? Does it make me want to post up my own picture by way of self-validation? Does it fuel my attachments? In an objective and compassionate view, how many of these posts really matter or take me closer to self-realization or my own dharma? I'm not asking you to trawl through and trash all of your friends for their attachments. because as we're all one, they are simply being us, right? I'm asking you to apply a different lens to an activity that all of us spend a lot of our precious and limited time in. Time to do a little renunciation and to revisit the eight limbs of yoga in this exercise, to remind yourself of stilling down, cleansing the mind, turning in, connecting and finding union, and stay 60. The internet and all of the broader applications of technology that have emerged from it are a boon for connectivity, for information sharing, for showing people that their tribes exist and they are not alone in their thoughts and beliefs. It is an irreversible change to how we do business and communicate, and it can be your best tool in reaching out and finding the people who it is your dharma to connect with through your good hustle. All good. Take the time to readjust your lens on your own attachments. Here's a tip, this could take a while, and bring your new vision to your social media interactions. If it is taking up too much time and emotional space in your life, pull back. Post mindfully. Stop looking for praise and validation. Actively don't use your channels as a way to stay caught in the eight worldly dharmas. Use social media as a space to serve others and genuinely connect with love and compassion. The social trivia of endless news feeds is the trash that we are filling our brains with. These are the irritating and invasive thoughts that bounce up and down in our minds while we are trying to settle into our meditation. I think sometimes our minds in meditation just look like a rolling social media feed as we play through our catalogue of wants and wishes, fears and hates. I'm not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm saying that the water needs to be purified through stillness, letting the mud settle to the bottom so the lotus can grow. If you can use all your restraints of meditation to engage and lovingly observe the flow of attachment on social media without desire, craving, aversion and suffering, great. If not, it might be time to employ some renunciation tactics and reallocate the time. I have a friend who's a psychotherapist and a Buddhist who uses social media as part of his business. He has a strict practice of digital engagement, working on his business in the morning after his meditation practice, scheduling posts, writing blogs and responding to people. In winter, when he sees the sky turn darker earlier and his clients get more introspective and affected by the cooler weather, he initiates a total social media hibernation from his personal social media channels, not looking or responding except for business reasons. This is his version of digital renunciation and retreat. He is turning inwards from the madness of attachment in the world and removing that distraction and junk from the mind. I think it is a great strategy for everyone and an important stake in the ground to remind ourselves that our lives and the lives of others have meaning outside of the digital domain. We just have to get out there and remember that the good hustle is a lived experience, both in mind and body. Social media is an excellent place to observe the eight worldly dharmas in action and your interaction with them, especially your attachment to reputation and praise. The advent of social media was undoubtedly up there with the Industrial Revolution and mass land and air transport in terms of the transformation it created in how, when, and where we do business. It gave us the capacity to connect through lines of shared interest, created communities, and began to move information at speeds never before experienced. One of its most critical uses was and is connectivity. The reimagining of society and community along digital lines rather than geographical ones. It literally opened up the world to us and in doing so created somewhat a democratization of information and voices. With all change, there is disruption and collateral damage. As Arjuna was all too aware in Gita's battle of Kurukshetra, the battle would kill millions of people and sentient beings. But as Krishna so persuasively argued, it was necessary for the battle to happen and for Arjuna's dharma to be part of it. The beginning of the end. Writer Elizabeth Gilbert's thesis in her book Big Magic, which I cited lovingly earlier, is that creative ideas call you, and if you aren't ready for the call, they will eventually move on and lodge with someone else who is ready to execute. This isn't a good or bad thing. It is simply a thing. And giving the ideas a vehicle to emerge from is part of the human condition. She could well have been talking about dharma, as throughout your life, your Dharma will have popped its head up in the form of opportunities or windows into another world that you may have chosen to take or looked wistfully through before turning back to what you were doing. I like this idea of creativity striking humans and recognizing